This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Because for me, climate chaos is a disaster that capitalism accelerated, distracted us from, and then limited our response for life-critical decades. Today, the global capitalists are now coaxing experts and politicians to spend our public funds on yet further distractions. They pretend that technology and enterprise will fix the collapse of the biosphere so they can then keep their income and privilege and their prestige. That is why this UN conference is becoming a career fest and trade fair at the end of the world. We see that these halls are full of people busy demonstrating their concern and capability to each other to create a shared delusion that infinite green growth is both true and moral.
That was Jem Bendel, founder of the Institute for Leadership and Sustainability at the University of Cumbria, UK. He was speaking in Egypt at COP27. Later in this show, you will hear Bendel and Harvard's Dr. Yi Tao again at COP27 with better audio. Yi Tao explains how millions of mirrors on land could reduce global heating. Bendel says our situation is just that dire. Then he apologizes for the way scientists and academics have blindfolded us from the awful truth. But first, a best of Radio EcoShock replay. In this world of ours, at least 600 million people cannot plug in. They are off-grid, but not by choice. Deep in the Amazon, a team of academics and engineers are trying to bring lights, refrigeration, and cell phone charging with a combination of solar panels and small generators suspended in jungle rivers. What they learn can teach us the real path to independent, distributed energy for all, but it's not as simple as you think. This project is described in a new paper published in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, on November 28th. The title is Advancing Convergence Research, Renewable Energy Solutions for Off-Grid Communities. We reached the lead author, American anthropologist Dr. Emilio F. Moran. He is the John A. Hanna Distinguished Professor at the Center for Global Change and Earth Observations at Michigan State University. From East Lansing, Michigan, Emilio Moran, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Nice to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us. At first, my reaction to this paper was that it might be too academic for our audience, but then we find a real-world experiment in one of the toughest off-grid places, the unconnected Amazon. But even there, you say, even the most isolated communities in the Brazilian Amazon watch national TV and use social media to communicate rapidly. How is that possible?
Well, ever since I remember more than 3 or 4 decades ago, even the most isolated Amazonian village will watch the national news at night and then the 8 o'clock soap opera by connecting their TV to a 12-volt car battery. That is a priority. People went into town once a week to make sure they had a charged battery, and then they ran the TV so they could do those things. And the national news allowed them to keep, pace with what's going on, and they're very devoted to the global 8 o'clock soap opera. And, of course, as you would suspect, football.
Well, actually, I lived that way for 8 years with my wife in northern Canada, so I know what that's like, just hugging a battery into town. Now, your team's new paper describes remote communities getting a few hours of electricity daily from diesel generators. Why not just bring in bigger generators and run them 24/7?
Well, because these people are very poor. They can hardly afford. I mean, the tradition was that they could afford, when prices were good, 4 hours of diesel power a day between 6 and 10 p.m. to illuminate the community, to be able to eat with some light in the evening. And that even now, that's not possible. The price of diesel has just skyrocketed. The people simply are unable to pay for it. So actually, they're in the dark in several cases that we have seen. And a bigger generator is just not a possibility.
You talk about the difficulties and expense of providing local power through a generator, and we don't have to go to the Amazon for that. Many communities in Canada depend on diesel generators, including a lot of northern Aboriginal people. Some of these communities are too far north for solar to work, in the dark months at least. Can the breakthrough method in your paper, which you call the convergence framework, can it work in other parts of the world?
Well, the method is one of trying to get away from a top-down solution, which is traditional with engineering technological projects, where somebody thinks, let's give people energy, let's bring in diesel generators, let's get them a solution, and then they leave. And that type of approach is what we're trying to get away from, is that the community has to be empowered to actually come up with what kind of solution can they sustain after you leave. Can they sustain fixing it? Can they sustain it? Can they govern it in a way that it really won't end with your project leaving? The example I use is that Brazil had a very big project. They installed millions of solar panels. In less than 5 years, 80% no longer functioned because they forgot to train people to make sure that they knew how to maintain and clean those solar panels. We want to do the opposite. We began last August by training people from six different communities, and then they are part of the installation. In fact, we just installed the first community's solar power this past week.
In the old model, well-meaning people and profit-seeking companies would want to install a top-down system, as you say, a prepackaged energy system. And it sounds almost like a kind of energy colonialism. What are some of the causes of local resistance, maybe even to clean energy?
Well, the resistance to clean energy comes from feeling insecure that these outside people are bringing you a solution, and then they're going to leave. I mean, they already have seen this kind of colonialism before. So they worry that you come in, you solve a problem, and they already know what's going to happen at the end, which is you're going to leave and it's not going to work. This has happened all over Africa with, you know, pumps to pump water for irrigation. It's happened all over the world where European countries or the U.S. come in, provide great technology, and then they leave. But there never been an effort to make sure the people were empowered to know what to do once you left and that they could afford it. That's the other, just like with the diesel generator, they have to be able to afford it. It has to fit in within their pocketbook.
We had a project here called the Great Bear Rainforest, where we tried to save a vast area of intact forests in British Columbia. And the study team needed to find out what areas were biologically wealthy that we needed to protect. But First Nations people were reticent about putting their best fishing and hunting grounds on any map where someone might find and poach and take their food. The world is not really built on trust, Emilio, and rationality, but on history. And in many of these unconnected places, from the Amazon through colonial Africa to parts of India, history has not been kind. Social trust is low. That might lead to rejection. Did your team wrestle with this?
Well, the article talks about how we started our research by doing a print media search of sources of what do the Brazilian media say about hydropower, because that is the immediate experience of people in this Amazonian region, is that they have built some very large hydropower dams. They make great promises to people of giving them energy, cheaper energy than they had before. And the actual story is that all those hydropower dams they have built, including Belo Monte, which is one of the biggest in the world, ended up not giving these people the energy. The energy was sent off to the large cities on the east coast of Brazil, São Paulo, Rio, etc., or to industries in those areas as well, the industrial parks. The people, they had all the damages from building them, and they had none of the benefits. So we wanted to know to what extent that experience, whether it be experiential or just information through the media, might be affecting their ability to adopt our technology.
And you even created an animated video for this project.
Yeah, we developed a small animated video to start the conversation with the community. Before we sort of promise anything, we wanted to say, well, this is what we're thinking of. You know, you have diesel generators, and, you know, they are polluting, they're costly, et cetera. We want to talk to you about the possibility of having a clean energy source that would include solar and some small river engine. And we want to talk to you about together developing the appropriate scale of the solution that fits you. And it was a way to start the conversation with them.
When it comes to energy solutions, your team finds a disconnect between engineers and other disciplines. What do you mean, and is that enough to stop implementation of energy for those who need it?
Well, the disconnect is that even today, engineering education is all about the math, it's all about solving a problem, but it's not always about finding the right solution for the people. It is a solution that is ideal for the technology companies that are running the show. So, for example, in order to counter that tendency of engineers in our team, we began by saying every meeting we had, once a month we met as a team, and I always began the meeting by saying, okay, remember, we're not trying to develop the most efficient turbine to produce energy for these communities. I don't want to make sushi. The most important thing in your turbine development is not to kill the fish. Because that's why we're doing this. We're doing this to do what the dams do not do, which is to protect the ecology of the river. You know, they understood that. In fact, we had one PhD student who just published an article, in fact, where he researched all the ways in which you can protect the fish from the blades in a turbine and what kind of speed, what kind of materials you need to use in order to reduce virtually to zero the mortality of fish where they're put in contact with the turbine.
And these turbines in the Amazon, there's a lot of stuff floating down there, a lot of vegetation material, a lot of silt, even snakes you mentioned. So they need some maintenance. Are you able to train local people who may have less education and certainly less money to maintain these high-tech energy systems like the run-of-the-river project?
Yeah, well, you have the right idea. It is not as high-tech as it could be because the priority is that people be able to maintain it. For example, an example of convergence here is that we're working with engineers who have worked with hydrokinetic turbines before, and they did run across the problem with maintenance, basically every 2 weeks, sometimes even more every 2 weeks. You have to pull out the turbine out of the water, clean it, because it gets full of organic material that's flowing down the river. And that is the challenge. How do you set up the turbine in a way that makes it easy to pull out and clean? Well, in the process of interaction with the community, one fellow who works with a company that works with other technologies like this, he said, well, instead of having the turbine anchored to the bottom of the river or held by an arm to the bank of the river, why don't we put it on a floater? And then in the floater, the people can get, you know, come in their canoe, get on the floater, and then just pull up the turbine on a slider, clean it, and put it back down. So that reduces the complications. And that was done basically interaction with communities where that's a solution. We hadn't thought of a solution. That's what we mean by this inclusive engineering. You need to include the people in doing the engineering. You can't just come with a solution. You have to make them be part of the solution.
Now, here's where I think the difficult work comes in understanding the theory that you're putting to go along with this project called the Convergence Framework. How would you explain that to people outside the university world?
Well, it is really you might call it a bottom-up approach or a sideways approach. In other words, we are very much running counter to a top-down solution to a problem. We're saying, okay, the people know there's a problem. They don't have energy. They want to have a solution. How can we together develop a solution that works for this community? And we expect every community is going to have a slightly different solution because the river varies in speed, it varies in organic material, organics, how rich it is in fisheries. Every location is going to have some characteristics, and the people, as you mentioned before, the people really treasure those natural resources that they have in the rivers. And so you want to protect that, and you want to tell them you understand that you want to protect that resource. So let's together figure out what's the best way to do that. That's what we call inclusive engineering, a kind of a bottom-up approach, where the important thing is to work together with the community to come up with a solution.
So we find in the paper and in Table 1 an emphasis on convergence, which emerges. What does that mean? Can you give us an example of emerging convergence or deep convergence?
Well, it's that example of the turbine mechanism for cleaning it. That's something that emerged from interaction with community, discussing the problem of cleaning it, discussing the turbine that we had designed. We had a design, and the people seemed to have some problem with our design. So in the interaction, you know, they came up with this solution of this slider and a floating turbine instead of one that is anchored. That is an emergent solution.
Okay. Now, this framework, at least the first trial of it, required a lot of personnel, including some well-paid experts in universities in both America and Brazil. There were multiple field trips to the Amazon during the pandemic, I might add. And while I get the principles involved, I question whether this approach can scale up to service hundreds of millions of people who don't have power on several continents. What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, we're doing something that is, you know, a prototype, basically. It's a proof of concept. We want to see if our solution works. We know that it's, you know, a first trial. We expect to do better in the next installation that we did the first time. And we'll get better at it as we do it more, as we get comfortable with interacting with the community. But it does take more time. I'm not saying that this approach is an easy solution. That's why people have relied upon top-down solutions. It's easy and quick. You get it done, you get out of there. But that's not what we're saying. To have sustainable solutions, you have to be willing to take the time with the people that you're trying to help, that they can afford it and that they can manage that thing long after you're gone. It will scale eventually, but certainly not in the same way as the simple top-down solution, for sure.
Well, I think a lot of what you just said also applies to people, say, in North America or Europe who want to make their own community-independent power systems. You have to remember the maintenance and the culture to look after it.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@eagleshock.org. That's radio@eagleshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Emilio Moran from Michigan State University. We're talking about what it really takes to install renewable energy with lessons learned from the Amazon. Now, the method that you use, the convergence framework, does it assume a relatively open society? Can it work where no one is allowed to operate in a democratic or participatory manner?
Well, since we're not talking politics necessarily, I would think that it would work anywhere, except in extremely authoritarian regimes where even the semblance of participation by people in decisions is not allowed. But I would think that solving a problem involving people is not as politically dangerous as it would be in some other topics. So I think it would work even in authoritarian regimes. For example, we have had Bolsonaro in Brazil, who was a major disaster for Brazil and for the Amazon. And, you know, I've been able to work in Brazil all these years, but you have to learn to do your work quietly. And if you don't do it quietly, it is very dangerous.
Well, can these social machines become resilient to climate change? I mean, suppose the plan finds a series of run-of-the-river generators are the best answers for communities along a tributary of the Amazon. But then, and this has already happened, the river almost dries up for a year or three due to climatic change. Well, then what?
Well, I mean, I agree with you. I think that the solution that they offered for hydropower was to have run-of-the-river dams. But that is not a solution because, as you say, the river goes down. Belo Monte, in July, Belo Monte Dam, 11 gigawatts of energy, installed capacity, stopped producing energy. It went to zero. And it has not produced energy since July to now. And the river is even lower now in November than it was in July. So that's a disaster. I mean, this is one of the biggest, you might say, footstools for the entire hydropower industry in Brazil. And it's not producing energy. So, yeah, dams are not the answer in a climate change world. Now, the turbines that we're talking about, you know, a 2-meter turbine that goes in even small streams. And you can move it around to where there is water. So it's not the big infrastructure that we imagine with hydropower dams. These are small, you know, portable engines that can be located anywhere there's water.
I was talking with energy analyst Richard Heinberg, and he warns that increasing renewable energy is not really replacing fossil fuels. The green power is just added to a growing pile of fossil fuel generation. And in fact, your test community decided to keep their diesel generator just in case, totally understandable. Is there a danger that diesel engines will keep running even after river power and solar are installed?
No, I mean, again, one of our criteria from the beginning is whatever solution we have has to be way cheaper than diesel. Otherwise, it's not going to be adoptable by the population. The cost is one of the big problems for them. And so, sure, they're going to keep their backup diesel generator because when we have to repair the solar panels or something, they don't want to be without energy altogether. So they're going to keep it as a backup, but not necessarily produce any power because, again, they're not able to afford it. But it is a good backup, and we support that as a backup solution. And as they develop more solar power, more power from the panels and from the small in-stream turbine, they'll be able to rely on that for all their energy. Sure, everybody wants more power, but we spend time in our training course saying that you have to learn about the limits of energy. You have to learn not overtax the system, otherwise it will burn up. So there's a lot of education that has to go. That's why it's slower than the other solutions. That's why they failed in those millions of panels they had installed before. It's easy to give panels to people, but if they don't know how to maintain it, they won't work. And in our case, we want to make sure that the people know how to govern, how to save money, that they're no longer spending on diesel fuel. They can save that money in order to be able to repair the system afterwards. So we spend time discussing how they envision the future of the energy supply in the community, how much they feel they need to save, how much are they spending now, what proportion of what they are saving from not having to buy diesel can they allocate to this repair and maintenance fund for the community. So we spend quite a bit of time working on that. They're on their own. That's the other thing they know. They know that we're not staying. They know they have to take care of themselves. But for them, it's an important thing to have.
Another gem in this paper, perhaps coming through your own lens of anthropology, is the way humans react to anything new. And I think this applies widely to tech changes, but also to the pandemic and to climate change. Tell us about diffusion of innovations, as proposed by the late Everett Rogers, and how that applies to replacements for fossil fuels.
Well, any kind of innovation, whether it be a replacement for fossil fuels, according to Rogers, it follows a sigmoid curve, an S-shaped curve that starts low and slightly ramps up until and then it plateaus. And that, what does that mean? It means that in the beginning of a new idea, a new innovation, you have slow adoption of the new idea. Why? Because only a few people immediately see the benefit and see that it benefits them. Most people are a little reluctant to jump on the ship of a new technology. And then as the people who are the early adopters of the technology succeed, other people can see that they're saving money. In the original research for that was out of hybrid corn in the Midwest. And, as the farmers who had more land saw the young experimental farmers doing better with their corn harvest, they began to adopt hybrid corn. And then it becomes, a very quick exponential increase in adoption of technology. And then there's always some people that are reluctant to adopt because they really don't have the means, they're risk averse. They're just not sure it's for them. That takes, 20 to 30 years before they will adopt. I mean, he had all this very clearly laid out. The first group is a decade, the second group is another decade, and the third group is the third decade. It takes a long time to get everybody on board. But it does mean that people who work in innovation have to be ready to accept that it's going to take a decade for the majority of people to begin to see the benefit of the new technology. And I don't think we have had that conversation about renewables so much. People are, one, they continue to be dependent on fossil fuels. And yet when we talk about switching over, whether it be electrical cars, same problem with electric cars. People are saying, what about the range? You know, I'm nervous about, you know, not having enough electric power to go where I want to go. And it's really crazy. I mean, I've reflected on that myself because, I mean, I don't drive that much. But even I am reluctant to go to an all-electric vehicle. I have a hybrid, but I'm reluctant to go to an all-electric because it only has a range of 250, 300 miles. Well, I hardly ever drive that much in a single clip. It would be a rare event, and most of the time if I drive that much, I'll probably end up renting a car anyway. But I think a lot of people, even educated people, are reluctant to switch over because they want to see more people adopting. They want to see more experiences. They want to see the community adopt it. There's a community element to innovation.
Could you tell us about the current state of this Amazon local power trial? What do you call it? Where is it? And how is it going?
Well, we had the first installation this past week. So it went well. It's a small installation. Again, we didn't want to do a big one on a, you must say, proof of concept installation. This is a very isolated community. It takes 15 hours by boat, actually switching the size of the boat three times to get there. It's hard to communicate how truly isolated these people are. So we wanted to have a first experience at a small scale with a small community with a small number of panels to see, you know, what it would take to do the logistics of getting the panels there in small canoes. You know, anything bigger than a canoe, it doesn't go most parts of the year. And so we wanted to see how that worked. Again, we wanted to do it earlier when the water was higher. The water was dropping now, so it made it a little harder to do. So we're weighing all those factors in looking at the other six communities that we are planning to install the systems in. Having this experience, I think, you know, we are examining the lessons learned and how we can do it, you know, a little more efficiently next time. Basically worked. I mean, the people were trained in August. They participated. The people from that particular community participated in the installation. They built the structure for the panels. They built a connection to, again, their priority was the church and the school and providing enough power to charge their phones and the internet. That's the initial priorities they have. They're going to have other priorities for sure. But that's, we said, okay, if you have to choose, what are the top priorities? Those were the top priorities. That's what we did. At the next community, who knows what the priority will be? I think the next one has already told us they want to have a water, pump water from a well. That's a priority for them, and so that's why we're gonna do that.
Well, everybody likes to think up reasons why independent distributed power could fail. But what if this method succeeds? What are the benefits that you hope for if this scales up?
Well, I think we already see that where it is allowed by the electrical companies. For example, my daughter lives in California, and they have a very good deal where she didn't even have to buy the solar panels. A company came to her and said, do you mind us installing panels, and we'll buy the energy from you. So basically, she doesn't pay for energy. She actually gets a payment at the end of the year back for her contribution to the grid. In the case of our communities, these people are so far from the grid, it's not even funny. So they're going to have to be self-reliant because the government has never found it economical enough to reach them to give them power. So I don't worry about, you know, what if the grid reaches them? Well, if the grid reaches them, fine. That's great. But people who are reached by the grid already in Brazil are putting solar panels because the price of energy is so high from the grid that they can't afford it. So now people are paying just a minuscule amount when they install solar panels compared to what they have to pay the company. And as long as the electric company allows it, that is a terrific solution to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. Except the companies are not collaborating. For example, they are trying to impose a 40% tax on any new solar panels that are installed in order to reduce the currently very fast demand of people installing on their own their solar panels and disconnecting from the grid. And they don't want that. So they're basically using their lobbying ability to convince Congress in the state of Pará to impose a 40% tax on new solar panels.
That's a whole other can of worms, and it's happening all over the world in many societies. So what's next for you in your research, and what are the next steps for this convergence framework?
Well, we'll continue to try to improve our understanding of how to have social science inform engineering. We'll continue to try to scale up from our experiences in the Amazon to other communities. You know, I expect that this article and our experience would lead to other communities getting interested in contacting us, and we can share our knowledge and expertise to help them do that. I mean, our dream would be to have, you know, every community that's off the grid see that a solution is possible and that they find some kind of partner that will allow them to do that. We were fortunate to have funding from the National Science Foundation and from the MOD Foundation that are committed to those kinds of things. The MOD Foundation, in fact, is the one that allowed us to have the solar panels. The NSF contribution was on the turbine. The MOD Foundation, which is a foundation committed to helping indigenous people have access to energy and solar panels, is what helped us do our work in this first installation.
So, listeners, the article about this project is now published in PNAS as Advancing Convergence Research, Renewable Energy Solutions for Off-Grid Communities. Our guide is the lead author, Dr. Emilio Moran, from the Center for Global Change and Earth Observations at Michigan State University. And I'll put a link to this paper and more in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Emilio, thank you for talking with us today.
Many thanks for inviting me. It was a pleasure to share ideas.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Jem Bendel and Yi Tao share a common life twist. Both were recognized experts at the top of their fields, and both changed their lives and careers once they recognized the dark reality of rapid climate change. Authors of books on corporate responsibility and sustainability, Jem Bendel gave keynote speeches at international conferences. He founded an institute at the University of Cambridge teaching sustainability to elite experts and bureaucrats from all over the world. Then Bendel sort of dropped out, labeling his former field of sustainability a failure. His latest book is Deep Adaptation, Navigating the Realities of Climate Chaos, and that was written with Rupert Reed. That is the Jem Bendel who spoke at a forum organized at COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh. It was by the activist group Facing Future TV. With him was Dr. Yi Tao. Tao is a science star with a doctorate in chemistry and work in physics. While at Harvard, Yi Tao abandoned that work to focus on the incoming threat of climate change. Fearing heating and weather instability, Tao looked for solutions, or at least a technology that could cool us a bit. Discarding all the tech that needed too much carbon to install it and run it, he arrived at mirrors to reflect the sun's energy back into space. You get a fast introduction into the Mirror Project in this Facing Future TV talk. Here we go with Jem Bendel and Yi Tao, recorded at COP27 by Facing Future TV.
My name's Professor Jem Bendel, and I'm delighted to be with you today to chair and speak at a panel on what we're calling climate honesty, ending what we also call climate brightsiding. And I'm very pleased to be here with Dr. Yi Tao, who's going to be presenting about the MIR framework, and also to be here in collaboration with Facing Future TV. There's an article in The Guardian today about the big word on all scientists' lips, scary. And it's difficult to be scared all the time. But emissions are up, atmospheric concentrations are up, temperature, sea levels, hunger, they're all rising. We know all of that. But there's also something we know which is far more incriminating of all of us here, which is the talks and agreements at the UNFCCC over the past decades have not managed to change any of that. Instead, they consistently move the goalposts. Back in May 92, when the UNFCCC was formed, member states agreed to cut emissions to stabilize atmospheric carbon at 354 parts per million by 2000, 22 years ago. But annual emissions climbed 65% since then and were at an all-time high last year. Back in 2009, the world's climatologists, the top ones of the world, got together and issued with something called the Copenhagen Consensus that said if global emissions had not peaked by 2020, we would face inevitable catastrophic changes. But annual emissions, as I've said, continue to rise. So they might continue to move the goalposts, but we can't play games with nature. Nature will always win, because nature actually owns us and not the other way around. Faced with the bad news, some experts are asking myself and my colleagues to calm down. They finally admit that, okay, it's already worse than we thought it would be, but don't worry, it's not going to be as bad as we thought it would be. They say we just need all societies on the planet to throw their emissions into high-speed reverse, have negative emissions technologies prove all independent analysis right and actually be useful, and also be blessed with some climate luck from the ecosystems that we've already disturbed being friendly to us rather than amplifying what we've done wrong. Opinion surveys now regularly show that vast numbers of people don't believe that that's going to happen, especially the young and increasingly numbers of people across the global south. In response, we see the professional talk shoppers criticize folks for being too negative. But people losing their livelihoods or being displaced from their homes are not going to benefit from such stubborn optimism from the professional classes. Rather, this kind of climate brightsiding, where we're made to doubt what we can now see with our own eyes, is actually limiting our conversation on our scope of action and our urgency. It means we don't support disaster risk reduction as much as we might. We don't support adaptation and reparations as much as we might. It means we don't support rapidly deployable technologies that could help people who will suffer the most and the soonest, which is something we're going to hear about today. It also means, though, we don't question the power structures that are sending our children into this hellscape. And it means we don't abandon all the old ideas about ourselves and our work. Therefore, we don't allow ourselves to become much more radical in how we respond to the climate crisis. So, as I said, it's difficult to be scared all the time. Complete climate honesty is painful, and it's going to get more painful, but it's necessary to try to reduce the harm. Today, we're going to hear from Dr. Ye Tao about some of the awkward science on climate change, currently ignored, about a net zero paradox, and a new initiative that seeks to reduce growing suffering that he founded. When working at the Rowland Institute of Harvard University, Dr. Tao realized just how bad the climate crisis was becoming. So in 2020, he left what he was doing and founded the MEAR framework. It's his response to his understanding of the accelerating and ultimate consequences of the climate crisis on our delicate web of life. He comes at this with a very relevant education as a biochemist, physicist, material scientist, and he brings the benefits of that multidisciplinary background in engineering and in science to his new work in the climate crisis. So I'm very pleased he's going to present to us for a few minutes now.
So indeed, we really need to be telling the truth, the full truth of climate catastrophe and the state of the world before we can come up with very effective solutions, engineering solutions to combat the crisis. So today I'll be telling you about a technique that's based on MIRS that can simultaneously provide food system security, better shelters when there's a heat wave, and also much better access and the preservation of water resources. But before, the first point I want to hit is that we have another degree of warming in store for us, and that the IPCC has been downplaying this inconvenient truth. So when we burn fossil fuel, we not only emit the long-lived greenhouse gases, but also short-lived aerosols that interact with clouds and promote brighter clouds to cool the climate. And the result is that we don't experience the full impact of greenhouse gases, but rather the difference between the greenhouse gases and these cooling aerosols. So in the future, when we do indeed achieve 100% carbon neutrality, what would happen is that, at least in the short term, there would be a much larger amount of positive reinforcing heating the planet. So COVID-19 provided an opportunity to interrogate what happens when you have a sudden increase in the amount of heating power driving warming on planet Earth. So we had about 7% over the year of reduction, but it happened, you know, different times on different continents. So we know the dates of lockdowns, so it's sort of a random controlled experiment that we can interpret. When visible light reaches the ground, it becomes absorbed as heat. And indeed, in much of Europe, for example, we observed record levels of shortwave radiation reaching the ground. And in Asia, for example, in China, the increased radiation also led to increase in ground land surface temperature, which then drove stronger circulation patterns, leading to a record precipitation in recorded recent history. And this record-breaking event, scientists were able to attribute about 30% of the anomaly to the disappearance or temporary disappearance of aerosols from the burning of fossil fuels. And very recently in the United States, forest fires have also been partially linked to a reduction of emissions during COVID lockdowns. And curiously, the temperature anomalies, the precipitation anomalies, and also the humidity anomalies, about 30% were linked to the aerosols. We don't know where the remaining two-thirds are coming from. But in summary, in 2020, it was a really record-setting event. Many parts of the world experienced extreme hurricanes, temperatures, and floods. It appears that this aerosol component and perturbation to the aerosol is so important, it's quite important to understand how much there actually is. So our best understanding up to 2021 was that there's about 1 watt per meter squared of warming masked by these aerosols. And if we consider the translation from the heating power to temperature at the equilibrium state, we know that roughly that translates to 1 degree Celsius of warming that's still in store. The field studying this phenomena goes back to the 1920s, and we continue to make new progress. For example, last month, we discovered that even though sometimes when ships, they go over oceans, they create clouds sometimes, but sometimes they don't. But even when they do not create visible clouds, those tracks still contribute to cooling the planet. And we could be underestimating the cooling power by another watt per meter squared, which is very scary indeed. And the history of the IPCC has been consistently underestimating how much cooling this pollution is providing. So in the assessment report 5, the central value was 0.9 watt per meter squared that's hidden. But by AR6, it was up to 1.3 watt per meter squared that's hidden. In the curious special report, 1.5 degrees, in order for the resulting temperature curves to not cross 1.5 degrees very quickly, the modelers arbitrarily chose 0.7 watt per meter squared, even though that's contrary to evidence and everything we know. Not only did they have to arbitrarily use a smaller input parameter, which we know is false, they also had to shift the baseline down by about 0.15 degrees, just so that we do not have immediate crossing of 1.5 degrees when the simulation stopped to fossil fuel emissions. So basically, 1.5 degree target is dead, and 2 degree target is also dead. But yet, we still say that mitigating greenhouse gases is the only tool that's allowed, and that's problematic. And we know that as we continue to decarbonize, which is necessary, we will expose the vulnerable populations in the world, in India, in China, and in Southeast Asia, and in Africa, to the worst impacts, because there's more pollution there. So as we clean up, they will be exposed to more warming. So what do we do? For example, let's put some mirrors on the roof. So we did this experiment in California, and we discovered that just by putting these simple passive reflectors, we can decrease roof temperature by up to 30 degrees. We can also decrease interior temperature when there's no insulate the roof by about 5 to 15 degrees. And that can mean the difference between life and death in the global south, where temperatures are already increasing beyond 50 degrees Celsius. And even in well-insulated global north buildings, we can still measure an internal temperature decrease of 1 to 2 degrees Celsius. There's also opportunity to apply mirrors to save water. So currently, we're losing about 300 cubic kilometers of water just from our reservoirs. And terrestrial water storage deficit in agricultural areas is about 120 cubic kilometers. So if we could just prevent less than half of the fresh water from just evaporating away, we could go do a long way to solve the issue of water scarcity. So we performed the experiment, floating mirrors on the water, above the water, and below the water. And in all cases, we observed dramatic decrease to the rate of water losing. So in the raw data shown in gray, you may be wondering what those spikes are. So it's actually squirrels in the neighborhood coming to have a drink of water. And they seem to also prefer the bin with mirrors floating on top compared to mirrors that's submerged. So they don't seem to be bothered by the mirrors at all. And in addition to saving water from evaporating, the mirrors also cool the water substantially by up to 10 degrees Celsius. So you can imagine if we apply this technology to coral reefs, we could potentially save them from bleaching, because 10 degrees Celsius is quite a lot. So in summary, let's say we covered 85% of the global's hydroelectric reservoirs. We could save 30 cubic kilometers of fresh water. That's 25% of the global deficit. We could also, by virtue of reflecting away the light that would be otherwise absorbed by the reservoirs, we can reflect away 29 terawatts of global warming power. That's 2% of the problem. And if we covered 85% of all the freshwater reservoirs, we could more than solve the freshwater shortage problem and also address about 10% of the global warming problem. So what about the remaining 90% of power that's driving the warming? We have to use land, obviously. So in this field, you're seeing on the right experiments that are taking place in an airport in Plymouth, New Hampshire. So mirrors have been assessed to be not dangerous for pilots or planes. So where do we get all the materials to make all the mirrors? Well, I was just biking in the city here, and generally when you go to different places on Earth, there's a plethora of plastic, glass, and aluminum cans that just scattered around. But to us, that's a very important material resource to build out this infrastructure. So at MIR, we recently prototyped a system based on glass, bamboo, aluminum, and the recycled plastics. So a system weighs a total of 80 kilograms, but it has a surface area, mirrored surface area, of 70 meters squared, and that can offset the warming impact of 7 tons of CO2. And in terms of the emissions during the manufacturing, we have about 70 kilograms of CO2 emitted during the manufacturing, and also including transportation. The amount of carbon that's embodied in the infrastructure, both in the bamboo and also in the recycled PET and the high-density polyethylene, is roughly double that of embodied carbon emissions in the manufacturing process. We'll go into a metric which is called a cooling return on investment, and this system achieved a cooling return on investment of about 3,000, meaning for every joule of energy you spend to build a system, you can remove from planet Earth 3,000 joules of energy. And the cost of the system to offset 7 tons of CO2 is $100 at small scale using off-the-shelf component and a personal 3D printer. So globally, if we want to basically take care of further warming issues by offsetting 50 gigaton equivalent CO2 emission per year, if we had access to all the PET, the plastics, the glass, and the aluminum that's currently going to landfills, we have enough resource for this project for canceling further warming on planet Earth. And the energy that's necessary to build out this infrastructure can be found just by controlling leakage from improperly managed decaying food and also from the fossil infrastructure. So I will end with one important metric that can be used to assess all climate change mitigation strategies. So the central problem of global warming is that we have a continuous power of roughly between 500 to 1,500 terawatts of power driving the warming. So the upper bound, 1,500, includes the portion that's currently masked by aerosols. The problem is that humanity only has access to 18 terawatts, and that's everything that we do. So obviously, we're trying to perform a level of warming that's much larger than the technical fossil fuel power we have access to. So no matter how you slice the problem, what you have to do is for every joule that you can put into the system, remove 100 joules from planet Earth. Obviously, we have to also continue to live our lives. So in the very optimistic case, where we can use only 10% of the energy to perform the process, we need a cooling return on investment at least 1,000. So an air conditioner is about cooling return on investment of 3. And the very famous direct air capture achieves about 100. So it's basically 10 times too inefficient to be climate relevant. So in summary, most of the things that you have heard, direct air capture, green roofs, or carbon storage, is way below the threshold 1,000 for feasibility. And the only things that can work are direct cooling methods, for example, potentially including MIR. And with that, I'd like to show that birds and mammals interact with experimental MIR fields, and they don't seem to be bothered by them.
Yeah, thank you for getting through a lot of important content there in a very short space of time. I think what's really important is that complete climate honesty throws up these issues, such as the impact of cleaning up our air and what that's going to mean for people who live in cities in the global south and who don't have access to cooling systems. And so we do really need to think creatively about what to do about that. I want to say something about how we are beginning to see some more climate honesty, complete climate honesty, for some more top scientists just in the last few months, and how that actually is a real challenge to the IPCC and to the UNFCCC. Top scientists are now admitting the plausibility of bad to worst case scenarios. Papers like Climate Endgame, exploring catastrophic climate change scenarios. Climate Change and the Threat to Civilization, another paper recently out. And also the World Scientists' Warning of a Climate Emergency 2022. I'll just quote from the top one. There is ample evidence that climate change could become catastrophic. We could enter such endgames at even modest levels of warming, facing a future of accelerating climate change, while blind to worst case scenarios is naive risk management at best and fatally foolish at worst. So I do recommend that you have a look into that. What we're seeing actually then is in the peer-reviewed top scientific literature in 2022, what some scientists have been saying and other scholars for quite some years. For example, 2 years ago, over 500 scholars signed a public scholar's warning on societal disruption and collapse, which asked not just for the study of these bad to worst scenarios, but also to actually consider how we can begin to prepare for societal breakdown, disruption, or even possibly collapse. If you're interested in this, I recommend searching online for either climate honesty or climate brightsiding. To end, I want to talk to you about something we're calling the Scholar's Oath to the Future. The climate science consensus over the last years failed to predict the levels of volatility and damage that we're seeing. The most concerning science was sidelined, yet it's proving to be closer to reality than the past consensus. Now, the reasons why this establishment climatology, we could call it, failed to prioritize communicating bad to worse scenarios must be learned from as we're entering this new troublesome and scary, to quote The Guardian, time. And that learning must include scholars like myself and climate scientists, climate communicators and journalists reflecting on the past choices we've made about being cautious and reticent and pushing away the information that we don't want to consider because it's too troubling to us and the choices we've made. There is a risk that massive new funding is going to distort this sense-making process. We definitely need more radical approaches. So I want to tell you about something that 165 scholars have signed to launch here today. They come from 34 countries, and it's called A Scholar's Oath to the Future. So I'm going to read it publicly for the first time today. This is an apology and an oath of renewed commitment. It's an apology from me and my fellow scholars to you, the younger generations whom we are meant to serve. It is also an oath to learn from our past mistakes as we seek to better contribute in future. That future is bleak. You amongst the younger generations are clearer on that than many older people. You know that the total pollution and devastation has exceeded the planet's capacity to cope. You know that today's dominant economies compel that destruction to continue. You have a clearer sight of the situation than most people older than you because you are less compromised in how you assess this bad news. You are less likely to assume the future will be like the past. You're less likely to keep quiet about uncomfortable ideas for fear of hurting your income, reputation, or influence. You are less likely to try to believe something because it might numb your own pain. That is because you must live in the future that will exist, not one that many older people prefer to imagine when they dismiss your negative thinking. Scholars from around the world in many disciplines have known for years that the trends are in the wrong direction for humanity and life on Earth. Whatever corner of the world we live in, we have seen how our efforts to reverse worrying trends have not been working. We ignored all of that to allow credible lies to be put to policymakers, senior leaders, and the general public. We justified our complacency to ourselves with a variety of explanations that put our needs, pleasures, and fears first. And we blamed powerful others rather than our own part in this charade. Today, the rich countries, large corporations, elite institutions, and mainstream media all support the credible lies that subdue us so that we do not rebel against the global economic system. These lies form the modern face of processes of domination and exploitation that have existed for centuries. But today, we promise not to compromise anymore. When there is unsettling analysis, we will share it. When there is injustice, we will name it. When there is distortion by national or corporate interests, we will challenge it. If we fear a backlash, then we will both name that fear and overcome it. Then if you within the younger generations are critical of our efforts, we will respond with curiosity and seek to make amends, because we recognize that our role is to contribute to your future. So myself and my fellow scholars are sorry for our own part in not helping enough in the past. We promise to learn with you about how to reduce harm, uphold universal values, and enable futures that may still be possible. Therefore, I will tell others of this apology and oath and promote mutual support. Then every year, I will publicly reconfirm this commitment to you. That's the end of the Scholar's Oath to Our Future, which also Dr. Ye Tao has signed along with 165 of us from 34 countries. And we're going to be looking forward to engaging young people in how we make real on that renewed commitment. And Ye's already doing a lot of that, I know, with young people being playing a key role in getting you to this far and with the experiments and research you're doing. So thank you on behalf of the Facing Future team. Thank you, Ye.
That was Dr. Jem Bendel, COP27 by Facing Future TV. We also heard from Harvard's Ye Tao in the MEER project, spelled M-E-E-R. Find links to all this in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. We go out with a few more words from Dr. Jem Bendel at a press briefing in Egypt, COP27, November 2022.
The desire for ostentatious consumption is a global one, and it's a sign of sickness in modern culture. It's that culture which helps us destroy both people and planet, even when we can see it. And these conferences are perpetuating that culture under the guise of caring about this carnage. Yes, the 30 years of COPs have been a great success in helping the elites pretend something is being done while not actually addressing the root causes of the problem. Leaders here have less of a credibility problem than a capitalism problem and a consumer culture problem. Instead, a serious response to climate injustice would redesign our economic and monetary systems, our banking systems, to allow a post-growth era. Unfortunately, that's not going to be done voluntarily, which means that climate justice will need to involve struggle as much as request. So concerned people in the global north will be seeking more direct relationships with climate activists in the global south, helping them to build their movements that require change of us, not just requesting it of us.